sections, they're all in the handout. So I'd just like to welcome Emma Rowe from the University of Southampton, and she's going to be talking about farm animals as a visceral object.
Thank you. And just apologies to people from Aberdeen who heard this earlier on in the week. This is a shorter version. And thank you very much for inviting me to talk, Erica. So I'm going to situate basically the food animal within kind of contemporary food debates. So basically this is sort of an animal studies, food studies crossover paper in a way. So maybe some of you might complain, but where's that living animal? And I say that, it's not that apparent. Though it is there. So let's just look at some of these big questions quickly about, you know, in contemporary food debates. Do we have enough to eat? Have we got too much to eat? Issues around food insecurity, around kind of, you know, the resources of food, but also the waste geographies of food. Increases in population, how are we going to feed enough people? Then this question about who eats what and where. So this kind of the food distribution politics that we see happening. The health geographies of food as well. Who's getting too obese? Who's in poverty? Who's malnourished? And then also, how is the environment affected by food animal production? For example, methane emissions or the carbon inefficiencies of kind of animal feed to the actual crop of protein that we get out of it. So I'm trying to think about how we can kind of create an integrated approach to animal studies, food studies, that can help us to kind of tackle some of these questions. So where animal studies meets food, environment, and health studies. And I guess David Nally, he talks about the spatial paradoxes of the global food system. And I guess that's what I'm trying to understand. How do these spatial paradoxes come about? And how can we think about how the food animal as a body of stuff that gets carted around the planet, how that is perhaps a contributing factor? It's Tim Lang and David Barling and his colleague, I think David Carra, I can't remember his name, they kind of started to call for an integrated approach. So I guess I'm trying to think about how a material politics can help address some of these food crises, a material politics about how we can think about that body of the animal. There's kind of a history of thinking about the politics of food objects. There's this quote from Jane Bennett, and she talks about food as a self-altering, dissipated materiality. But it is also a player. It enters into what we become. It is one of the many agencies operative when we engage in the questions of what to eat, how to get it, and when to stop. So I'm thinking about how that food animal is part of this. And I guess one of the questions we might want to think about is, you know, how can we connect the health and nutritional well-being of the family eating curried chicken breasts in Swindon with the family eating soup using the stock from chicken beaks and feet in Cape Town? How does food as a player, how does the body of the animal actually work in trying to understand who is eating what and where in the world? So to understand food as a player, it places it in this materialised background in which humans think and act, which kind of in many ways undermines that autonomous agency of the human as the rational actor. Because we're interested in how humans get drawn into doing things because of the stuff that's in the world, the stuff that's in the background, and how that makes us kind of end up having to handle things in particular ways. I guess one of the more recent papers in this kind of work is Mara's wonderful paper about the happy chicken. So she talks there about the opportunity to think about an alternative site of political engagement that's a step away from kind of a linguistic interaction in social and political and cultural studies about how we might think about how to do a politics, to instead moving away from what people talk about to actually thinking about the body of the animal or the materialities that we work with. So how can we relate the politics of food objects and material politics of food animals to those spatial paradoxes in the global food system? However, thinking about Mara's paper, there she's kind of assembling consumers and citizens and scientists in identifying what the happy chicken is. But perhaps where I'm trying to add to this debate is to also think about the digestive effects of eating happier chicken meat or eggs in relation to nutritional well-being, or the availability of happy chicken to eat and in what meal form for different communities around the globe, you know, what, how do they actually end up eating that, the parts of the happy chicken? Or what are the environmental costs of its production, processing, manufacturing, global distribution to find markets for all the parts of the chicken body? So to address these concerns about chicken is actually to the practices and processes of meat production, processing and retailing that I'm going to talk about in this paper. Specifically to consider how the farmer, processor and retailer envisages, identifies and handles the body parts of chickens and of other food animals. So in this paper, I propose that there should be greater analytical attention to be given to the body parts from the carcass. What I'm going to be calling the visceral objects that travel through the food and agricultural industry. By developing the literature on the politics of food objects, this paper considers the relevance of considering the politics of visceral objects through discussing the food animal itself as visceral objects. So this approach tailors the specificities of the different visceral matters, so the actual stuff, the flesh, as materialised objects becoming food. So to consider closely how various qualities and capacities of visceral matter are players in generating the foodstuffs produced, distributed and sold around the globe. So from this analytical position, it can be shown how and why different foodstuffs are produced, valued and distributed and sold to different communities, but which necessarily coexisted during the initial stages of production and processing. And so to address some of those, hopefully some of those spatial paradoxes about food that we see enacted in the world. So the rest of the paper makes this argument more useful to think about that this would offer a more integrated analytical approach to studying those spatial paradoxes. For where a consumer may think of eating pork, chicken and beef, for the meat processor and retailer, the detail is all in the body part and how many and of what body part and price they can sell. But this is attention to the question of selling body parts not only shapes the relationship meat processors have with retailers, that's what they're engaged in, selling body parts, but also farmers are also thinking about it when they kind of select different animals to be bred. It's about how that shape, how the conformation of the animal is. But before elaborating on illustrations of various practices of UK and European meat supply chain actors, I want to try and say a little bit more about what I mean by visceral objects as political protagonists. So visceral, so the Oxford English Dictionary describes the internal anatomic organs, also known as the innards, found within the cavity of the body as viscera. Okay, so I guess that's, you know, there is this term viscera already out there. And then there is also the use of the adjective visceral, which has been sort of commonly used to express the fleshy body, often the human body, as touched or affected materially by emotions. And that's been the sort of, in food consumption literature, it's been more the sort of emotional way of talking about a visceral geography of the consuming human body. I guess we could start thinking about that kind of sort of the gut reaction. I guess I'm trying to sort of thicken out that meaning, because this, to sort of flesh it out, as visceral becomes an adjective to describe also objects which are innardy, maybe we could say, which are of the innards. Objects, objects which are only found in bodies. And that these visceral objects are still materially affected. So they are, there is sort of, there's, I'm not pushing away any idea of an emotional side. I think there's evidence that shows animals' meat is, or flesh is also affected by their emotion, but also is resonant with the reality of matter processing. That you kind of, to create a body, you've got to have lots of different kinds of matters there, and they have a relationship with each other. It's interesting, there is already a sort of a turn towards thinking about a deeper engagement with the viscera's agentive capacities. In an editorial for Kuhl and Frost's New Materialism book, they identified the trend within biomaterialist writings for understanding the body as a visceral protagonist within political encounters. But maybe still here, the concern is more with the kind of gut reactions of liking or disliking, edible or inedible. And maybe, you know, they can still think about, could be pushed a bit further to thinking about the matter itself as a visceral player. So there's a couple of examples that I'm not going to go to any, but in much example, but I guess thinking about these three different types of carrots, you might like to think about which you would find edible. And the important thing is to think, is to recognise that it's not just the sensed outward qualities, but also some understanding of what's actually its consistency that is actually forming. What's happened to its matter? How much has it grown? What processes has the matter gone through that actually affects how you're judging it, whether it's edible or inedible to yourself? And just another example from thinking about how animal stress affects meat quality. Again, we kind of see how the quality of meat in the abattoir still speaks of the life of that animal that was living in a field and what it experienced, or what it experienced in the abattoir in the hours leading up to its slaughter, and how that has affected its stress levels and in turn the quality of the meat. You really want to be the middle four here. That's pale, soft and exudative. Which is like recent stress before slaughter, pale, dark and dry, prolonged stress. But you know, how you can start to see this idea of thinking about the viscerality, both the sort of, there is the emotional side, but there's also something about how matter, materiality itself changes, and how those body parts are connected to each other, which is how you end up seeing changes in actual flesh. Because I mean, to be able to respond to stress probably means more than just having, you know, a good backside to take a steak out of. Something else in the body has helped to generate that, so you kind of start seeing more kind of complex body emerging. So, what do we know? I mean, I guess one of the questions is, these examples I've given to you, they're a lot about bodies themselves, but I guess I'm interested in pushing it down to the body part. Because essentially that's what we end up eating, body parts. So what do we know about the body part as a visceral protagonist? Because I think that's something different from thinking about the whole animal body. So it's in the area of stem cell research that there's been most attention paid to the body part as a visceral protagonist. Stem cells are body parts, they exist incorporated into a whole body, and their status is as a part and not as a whole body. There's you know, different legality to them. Strathern has talked about them in terms of Euro-American property thinking as freestanding parts, bodily materials conceived as only partially independent from their corporeal origins. Maria Fannin has described body parts, again stem cells, as the designation of detached organs and tissues as things but not whole things, in her paper on stem cell banking and the problem of property. And Jane Bennett, she kind of talks about it following a more kind of science and technology studies scholar approach, which is kind of to be aware of how maybe a stem cell becomes available through the particular practices in the laboratory. But I guess, I think, yes, we can look at those particular practices, but let's also not forget all those other matters that are actually crucial to the generation of the stem cells and the generation of these animal body parts. So I think what is missing from some of those discussions about stem cells is any attempt to deal with how to think matters becomings with heterogeneous other accompaniments of other matters in bodies, because that's what we're talking about when we come to think about the animal body, the animal carcass. The stem cell is one matter kind in a body that consists of matter heterogeneity. It does not come into existence on its own. Not only are there specific practices that make it present in laboratories, but additionally, to Bennett's point, is to include in our analysis the specific matters found in other body parts that support its generation. So let's start turning now to think about the food animal as visceral objects specifically. Probably many of you, are, if you're doing work on food animals, then you're aware of the issue of carcass utilisation or carcass balancing. Because in comparison to extracting human body parts from human bodies, the meat carcass is a much more complex exercise involving many different matter kinds as body parts whose primary value, both pre and post-slaughter, is as commercialised edible matter, rather than located in valuing a human or living animal body's right to live. And I would say there's been insufficient attention to this issue of carcass balancing. this issue about how you think about the proportion of, for example, beef carcass weight that is present in various primal cuts in both the hindquarters and forequarters. This is what the meat industry has to contend with the whole time, is how to make a return of the whole animal's body. The edible matters of processed meat products and the other body products that come from a single animal carcass are illustrative of agentive characteristics of bodily matter, or the matter of body parts. Different kinds of meat matter found in the animal carcass, whether skeletal muscle, fat, organs or offal, are located, shaped and function differently in the corpus of the body, and equally go on to be handled and work differently, satisfying different consumption and taste. So thinking, first of all, these are some quotes from On the Farm. This is a farmer discussing how her living cattle will meet different carcass grades in the abattoir post-slaughter. She talks about the blonding, the lengthening of the carcass, and they're very, i.e. you'll get more rib steaks off their back. And they're also very consistent in the way they look, so you can keep getting a similar kind of looking animal, which is obviously very useful in terms of getting something on the shelf that consumers can constantly get repeated eating experience. But you can't get much fat out of them. They're supermarket breeds, not for the special meat counter, as she says. But they're not the poorly bred, they're not the manufactured beef. Most of the dairy beef, that's what she talks about, that goes to a different abattoir. She also says you can get 5% more for an animal for producing a carcass with a very high conformation. They are long, they have lovely rounds, and they have a lot of meat to the bones, so they're usually graded U+. So this is the kind of assessment of that animal carcass's body that happens in the abattoir, which farmers are always keen to know, how did their animals do? In the comments, we can identify the agentive visceral objects, the long back, the rack of ribbed steaks, the shape of the hindquarters. So here we're still on the farm with a living animal, and the farm is talking of these animals as bodies of different qualities of meat that will be commercially valued differently. The front end of a carcass may end up at a burger manufacturer, whereas the back end is found as steaks on a supermarket shelf. So meat processors become adept at drawing two different retail partners together, or maybe more, who share the same expectations about the quality of their meat, for example, comparable farm animal welfare standards, but who require different body parts. In this sense, bodies of a similar shape and size can still be valued differently because of how the farm production standards become integral to their viscera. But this is kind of the first example that describes how the rich variety of co-generated matter kinds are disassembled into their constituent parts and mobilised in different ways to meet the requirements of different customers, thereby creating different meat-based products that sit in different locations on supermarkets shelves, from fresh packed meat cuts to processed meat portions in a long life pie or pasty. But ultimately, they're from the same body. So we've seen not only the different members of the herd become attractive to different markets, but also different parts of the body of the animal can attain higher prices than others. Additionally, both of these differences in bodily value also vary according to different cultural norms, both between and within social groups and national cultures. The product is sold into a wide variety of different international meat cultures, and carcasses can change in value as you orient body parts to different markets. So this is a multinational chicken manufacturer who says carcass balance is a major problem with chicken. Different parts of the world eat different parts of the chicken. If you go into sort of Mexico and sort of South American parts, then they like the dark meat. You go to places like America, Britain, Italy, they like the white meat. So from the chicken manufacturer's description, we get a sense of the global distribution of the chicken carcass as it's broken down into body parts and valued differently across different food cultures. Indeed, the globalisation of food product distribution offers the potential to shift parts of the carcass unpopular in one country to a home in another where different culinary cultural practices exist. So next, we think a bit more about the brown meat. So for American and chicken and a European chicken process, there's also particular challenges. The breast meat or the white meat is the most desired part of the carcass in general for consumers from this part of the world. So here this chicken processor explains how a market is found for the wings and legs of, or the brown meat for broiler chickens grown in white meat loving regions of the world. When you're selling brown or white meat into that market, you need to find a home for the other part, and probably our biggest difference in cost of production between ourselves and Thailand is the fact they can actually sell everything in that chicken. So in a globalised market, where there may be little variation in the costs of chicken production, carcass balance is crucial for increasing profitable returns. There's a surplus in the global supply. I think I'm just going to go to the conclusion now. But anyway, they have to persuade customers in different ways to buy into the dark meat, and that's one of the biggest challenges. So, interestingly, just to add, so resource geographers have noted that we haven't yet found a way to kind of to work out the problematic of heterogeneous objects as kind of a waste problem. Yeah, and what we see in the food industry, waste gets turned into edible food for those people who end up eating the cheapest food, the least nutritional food, but they have to somehow make it edible. So this is my conclusion slide, which is this kind of approach hopefully sort of facilitates the connection between different body parts of different matter kinds. So the pink slime, the turkey twizzler with your beautiful ribeye steak. Feel the responsibility about when you eat a great steak, a great quality piece of an animal carcass, and think about what other bits of animal you've drawn into existence and who's eating those parts. I kind of talk about this as commercial practices. It's working with matter. It quickly becomes about the disposal of waste body parts to whichever mouths will eat them. So who gets what to eat, where, and what price is related to the exacting terms of the visceral object on meat practices. And I hope this offers us one way to think about an integrated approach to the effects of food animal intensification and the expansion and its expansion on health, nutrition and the environment, and may help us think about different ways of producing animals if we can take this into account. Maybe we need to think about the steak in the petri dish.